The secret to well-being is discovering the power that is your birthright. The power to create a happier, healthier life drawn from our own vast internal resources. Join Jules and her guests as they gently guide you to shift your perspective from the familiar negative to the divinely connected, a place that will not only positively impact your world, but possibly shift the planet. It's all right here on Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. So glad you could be here. We've got another terrific show for you featuring Dr. Rick Hansen, author of the most terrific best-selling book, The Buddha's Brain. You know what I really like about this book? It's all about understanding the power we possess internally to become happy. I've said it before, and it's so true. There is nothing more important than you being happy, because that is the place that you need to be to create from, as well as the place in which to allow your happiness to influence others and even the world through the ripple out effect. This is a great show, so sit back, relax, and enjoy our time together. We'll be right back after these words.
Need help realizing your dreams? As a hypnotherapist specializing in the law of attraction, Jules Johnson can help you to break through your critical mind into your manifested dream. Get started today by going to lawofattractiontools.com. Set up a personal Skype video or phone session. Law of Attraction Tools is there to help you turn your desires into reality. That's lawofattractiontools.com.
Enjoy your summer to the fullest by dropping that excess weight once and for all. HCGDropsPlus.com offers a comprehensive plan that includes HCG replacement drops, 360 support supplements to eliminate cravings and provide abundant energy, and 60 refreshing lemon hydration drinks made with stevia. Doyle from North Carolina dropped 113 pounds on the HCG Drops Plus program with no negative side effects. Don't let your excess weight weigh your spirit down. Go to HCGDropsPlus.com and get started.
Okay, it's cruise time again. I want you to go to www.lawofattractioncruise.com. That's lawofattractioncruise.com. Check out this incredible cruise of a lifetime. We are going to Mayan country on December 13, 2012 for 4 days on Royal Caribbean, Jewel of the Seas. And I want you to come with us. We're going to meditate in Tulum and feel the energies in which to welcome in the new paradigm, the golden age of peace, abundance, and we're going to have a spectacular awakening. Talk about creating at its finest. We're going to be in the most powerful spot in the world to create a spectacular new world. And I really, really want to experience this with you. So plan on getting out of the December snow and into paradise with us. Remember, go to lawofattractioncruise.com. On July 1st, I really want you to listen to my show featuring Joe Dunning doing an energy transmission, and I want you to listen from our brand new home. Yes, we are launching a brand new website that you are going to love, and we have a lot of freebies just for you. So I want you to come to our new home on July 1st, listen to Joe Dunning, get all of the wonderful freebies, and feel our excitement about the future as we have expanded into a fabulous new creation. It's all because of you listening. So please let me thank you by giving you something in return. And I'm hoping you're going to love it as much as I love giving it to you. Remember, Sunday, July 1st. You know, in the last few months, I've noticed many people becoming, the word dependent comes to mind, upon psychics for advice about their future. Well, I think talking to a psychic is so much fun, and going once or twice a year to give you probable outcomes based on your energy is not bad. It's really fun. But if you find yourself becoming dependent upon another for directions on how to proceed in your life, well, wait a minute. Something's wrong here. It's wrong because you have become dependent upon another human being to give you answers that you want to hear, rather than listening to the truth that lies within. In other words, you've kind of given away your power to make the decisions and to listen to that internal guidance system. I find this especially true with people who have broken up from previous loves. And there's always a question, will we get back together? Will I be alone for the rest of my life? And finally, can I manifest this person back into my life? Well, let's talk about this. Can you manifest a previous love back into your life? Well, you can only do it if the other person is willing. But yet, you probably need to ask yourself, if it didn't work out the first time, why would it work out the second time around? Going to a psychic means you are wanting to hear something that your gut may be telling you otherwise. Let's talk about divine connection with source energy. From the day you were born, you have had this inner guidance system that sends out bells and whistles to go forward or to stop. For some of us, and I'll put myself into this category, it takes us a lifetime to get quiet and to feel our divine connection. But make no mistake, if we listen, we will feel the answers. When you get quiet and focus in on the question, let the emotions rise up. If it feels yucky and you're feeling tension or sadness or angry, your answer is to hold off with any decision for a few days and then revisit it. Then proceed immediately into exploring why you are experiencing these emotions. And remember, these represent the contrast, which is essential for our motivation. But if you feel safe or secure or good, excited, passionate, or joy, then that is your connection to Source telling you to do it, to go for it. Let's repeat. Yucky means no, not now, and joy means let's do it. It's simple, isn't it? You have the answers within you. And only you have your own answers. So if you feel yucky, sad feeling concerning a question about a previous love and where he is, even though he hasn't called you in the last 5 years, that's your answer. It's the contrast telling you that you are on the wrong track. Wake up and start living your life to the fullest each day, being fully aware that you are powerful and magnificent. You are the creator of your life, and you can create everything you want with another person that may be just the perfect fit for you when you can release the past. You know your truth and improbable future actually lies within you. Well, we all know a psychic is not 100% accurate all the time, and they'll be the first ones to tell you that. A channel is not 100% accurate either, but often a psychic can influence your future. And if you recall, that's why Abraham Hicks never tells the person in the hot seat about their future. They leave the power with that person to create their future through their own feelings of well-being. Again, that's the reason the person becomes dependent upon a psychic or even another, because they are seeking answers of well-being from outside of themselves. Trust yourself, trust your gut, and trust your divine connection to source energy of all that is, and take your power back. Don't give it away. Keep it. You're the only one with the answers. And that's how it should be. And by the way, I have recently seen people become so dependent on the angels to the point where they have to ask for guidance on whether they should eat steak or eat salad or drive a car or walk. I have seen people become overly dependent upon God asking for deliverance of their lack, but not listening to their personal messages within. from their divine connection. We are human, and if we allow it in, we can have that spiritual experience. We can allow that connection with all that is to flow to us and to answer our questions. Can we become overly dependent on psychics, on angels, on God? Yes. Because we place our own divine power on the exterior entity rather than on ourselves. Remember, we have the divine right to choose which way we will go. That means we're human. That's what we're supposed to do in this lifetime. And if we simply follow our gut, feel our human feelings, we can't go wrong. Why is this? Because we are the divine essence of Source. We are the co-creators with God. We are connected, not separate from our Source energy. Therefore, we have the answers that God has for us within us. I hope that makes sense. So let's get on with tonight's show with Dr. Rick Hansen, PhD, who is a neuropsychologist and a meditation teacher. He is the co-founder of Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and edits the Wise Brain Bulletin, which is wonderful. To learn more about his wonderful book called The Buddha Brain, go to rickhansen.net, and it has additional information that you're going to find absolutely fascinating. Welcome, Rick, to Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Well, thank you.
So, Rick, let's start at the very beginning. Matter of fact, chapter one at the first sentence, which is very powerful. It states, when your mind changes, your brain changes too. So let's talk about that.
Well, when I mean the word mind, I mean it the way most neuroscience people mean it, not in kind of a cosmic sense, but more really down to earth. You know, a frog notices a fly. You know, our cat notices a mouse. I notice our cat noticing a mouse, right? So that noticing, in other words, the sounds we hear, the sights we see, and the thoughts we have about it, that's all information moving around inside the nervous system. That's what scientists mean by mind. They mean information, meanings, signals, memories, store instructions, like how to move my hand through the air right now. So I wave my hands around, you know, whatever. How to smile, how to interact with someone. You're a very nice person, I can tell immediately. You know, we learn those things. Okay. To make that happen in ways that are still kind of mysterious but are getting clearer and clearer and clearer, different to make mind happen, the brain has to happen. You know, different things happen. Neurons fire. Neurotransmitters swirl around, you know, circuits develop over time and fade, whatnot. Okay. The takeaway, though, goes the other way, which is that it's not just that as the brain changes, the mind changes. It's also that as we think, as we feel, as we hope, as we dream, as we suffer, as the mind changes, that leaves changes in the brain, both temporary changes and then lasting traces for better or worse. You know, there's a traditional saying in Buddhism, the tradition I know best in the contemplative traditions, that the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon. Well, the update would be the brain takes the shape of what your mind rests upon over time. So if you rest your mind on, you know, self-criticism or beating yourself up or this grumbling case about other people or nervous fear about the world or a sense of helplessness, darn, your brain will take a shape of low resilience, sensitivity to stress, depression, low worth, closed off from others, whatever. On the other hand, because in the famous saying, neurons that fire together wire together, mm-hmm. If you rest your mind on, you know, what you're talking about, rest your mind on the good things in life that are very real and objectively true. You rest your mind on the good quality in your heart, or you rest your mind on your little accomplishments and large ones every so often, you know, over time, then the brain will take a different shape. In that case, it'll take the shape of resilience, self-worth, open heart, greater capacity to help others and make this world a better place. And that's kind of the choice that faces us every day. You know, in the range of what's possible at any moment, whether we're in a really sweet place or someone's just hit our car, you know, running a red light. Whatever we are in that range of options, do we take the low end of the range or the high end of the range in terms of what we do with our mind? And those choices, you know, 10,000 times over the course of a lifetime determine its course and will gradually change the brain one way or the other. My book's about how to change it for the better.
Great. But inherently, our brain loves to focus in on the negative. Why is that?
That's a really important question. It does because in evolution, we had to go get carrots and avoid sticks, all right? It's important to get carrots, but if you miss a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid that stick today, whack, no more carrots together. You know, rule one in the wild is eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, you know? So the brain evolved what scientists call a negativity bias that has lots of effects that are really good for survival, but lousy for quality of life and lousy for long-term health. Because let's remember, when we evolved, most of our ancestors were dead by their 30th birthday, you know, 40th for sure. In that case, it made sense to have short-term benefits from stress reactions and stress hormones that were much greater than the long-term costs, because there weren't any long-term costs. It's all about seeing the sunrise, you know, in the Serengeti. But now, when people, I'm 58, almost 59, when people want to live long and prosper, my dad's almost 93. He just broke up with his lady friend. You know, he's pretty well.
All right.
You know, 92 is the new 72 or something like that. But anyway, you want to live well. So going negative, which was great for getting us away from charging tigers and saber-toothed lion tigers and whatnot, it's lousy today. So taking charge of the negativity bias of the brain is really important. That's why in my book, you know, one of the practices is about taking in the good, or another practice is notice you're actually all right now. You know, the part of the problem is that when you have a negative experience, the brain remembers it instantly, right? Once burned, twice shy. All right. But if you have a positive experience, it just has plain vanilla memory systems, which require that something be held in short-term buffers for quite a while, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, before it transfers to long-term storage. Well, how often do we actually do that? We might be having one little positive experience after another, but they're not retained in short-term memory buffers long enough to sift down into long-term storage. So it's like they're water through a sieve. But negative experiences get caught by the brain every time. The brain's biased. It's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. And that, to me, goes to taking action inside our own mind, including in ways I talk about in the book, you know, to trick the brain, to weave positive experiences into the fabric of the brain and the self.
Wow.
To me, that's one of the really cool methods that's grounded in science, but you know, and feels good and has a real impact over time. It's just one of many methods in the book, but it's one of my favorite, taking in the good.
So let's talk about a few more of those methods. How do we shift or reframe the way that we think? I know about monitoring our thoughts, but I got to tell you, it's a really difficult work in that you have to keep right on top of it. What do you suggest we do to reframe the way we think?
That's the big question, isn't it? And there are lots of ways, for sure. I think it's great to start with just one thing, you know, the title of my book. Just these days, life's so complicated. Can we just pick one thing at a time? You know, that helps me as a down-to-earth, practical kind of guy. So I think, you know, one thing for a lot of people, honestly, is just cooling the fires. Turning down the pressure, lowering the pressure, activating what's called the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system. It's this calming, soothing, relaxing wing of the nervous system that balances fight or flight, stress reactivation, and so forth. I think if people simply took a handful of times each day and did a long exhalation or three or four in a row, because the parasympathetic nervous system does exhaling. Sympathetic nervous system, that's the stress response system. It does inhale. That's why the heartbeat speeds up a little when you inhale and slows down a little when you exhale. A lot of yogic breathing is about long exhalations. I think one reason why singing makes people happy and relaxes them is that it's a long, controlled exhalation, which triggers parasympathetic activation. Anyway, a handful of times a day. No one even needs to know you're doing it. You know, go back to a place of basic calm, basic centering, basic soothing. Get the needle of your stress meter, you know, out of orange or red, back down into yellow or even better, green. I mean, that right there is a powerful practice every day. I'll give you a second one that for me has been very important lately. It's to appreciate. I don't know if you're a Lord of the Rings junkie like I am, but, you know, Wormtongue was this kind of evil character who was always whispering in the ear of the king and twisting his mind and tricking him and whatnot. Well, darn, Mother Nature is continually whispering in our ear. Be afraid, be very afraid, watch out, threat level orange, blah, blah, blah. That is great to keep, you know, rats and lizards and monkeys alive in the wild, but most of the time it's just not true, you know? If you think about it, you can make two mistakes in the wild. You can think, you know, there's a tiger in the bushes, but there's not. The coast is really clear. Or you can think everything's fine, but there's a tiger about to pounce, right? And what's the cost of the first mistake? Needless anxiety. What's the cost of the second mistake? You know, no more gene copies, right? So Mother Nature wants us to make the first mistake 1,000 times over to avoid making the second mistake even once. The impact of that is that we go through life needlessly anxious. And then laid on top of that is temperament. Some are more anxious than others, life experiences. And then, frankly, modern life, which bombards us with threat messages, constantly jacks us up. And then in ways that have happened 10,000 times throughout history, various political groups will use fear to gain or hold on to power. So the net of it, to me, is most people are much more anxious than they really need to be. So to help yourself, notice you're all right now. Not perfect, but you're actually all right now. That's a very powerful practice. Or beware, you know, just be skeptical of your sense of feeling threatened. When you notice you start feeling guarded or braced, you're not soft and open, you know, ask yourself, do I really need to be this guarded? Do I really need to be this vigilant? Do I really need to be this nervous? Sometimes you do. Dark alleys late at night, you know, yeah, there are real tigers in this world. I'm with people about that. You know, don't mistake the real tigers, large and small, including, you know, just in your life today. That said, the bias in the brain, Mother Nature tricking us, is in most cases that we don't need to feel so afraid. And that's the second practice I would offer to people. And if you can gradually appreciate that you're safer than you think in most cases, you can afford to feel strong, you can afford to feel protected, you can afford to be less guarded and less, you know, braced for a fight. That's a much better way to go through life.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that if we go to sleep at night and we're feeling full of anxiety so much that we can't sleep, what we need to do is start releasing that anxiety and just start focusing on being in the moment, laying in our comfortable bed and feeling good. Focusing on anything that makes you feel better.
Yeah, or walking down the street, or doing, you know, emails, or flipping, you know, doing the dishes. You know, I think that tune in and ask yourself, do I need to feel subtly this anxious, this apprehensive, this threatened? Or can I legitimately, factually afford to feel one step, if not more steps than one, safer, stronger, and so forth? And the interesting thing is when we deal with other people from this place where we feel less threatened, you know, then we're much less likely to, frankly, attack them. You know, the Buddha had a great saying, getting angry with people is like throwing hot coals with bare hands. You know, both people get burned. So kind of out of enlightened self-interest, if you help yourself feel less threatened, you're going to act in ways that are less threatening to others, who will then feel less threatened and won't act in ways that are threatening to you. It's a positive cycle this way.
When we get angry with other people, is that simply fear coming up in us?
Oh, yeah. I think underneath most anger is fear. Sometimes it's frustration, but it's often there's fear at the root. You know, underneath anger almost always, or as you know, softer, more vulnerable feelings. Being able to get at those feelings is, of course, very helpful for people. And I think it's, for me, from a, you know, you don't, you, if you just, kind of, it's like knowing a little teeny bit about how a car works helps you drive the car. You know, knowing a little teeny bit about how your computer works helps you run the computer. Knowing a little teeny bit about the brain, your biocomputer, you know, can help you a little bit. And one little thing to know about the brain, one of just a handful I think that's really important, is to appreciate that even though it's marvelous and can construct an internet that enables Skype and we can have language and share ideas, I'm not sure what to call it. I'm a guy. I'm bad at this. Your top, your shirt, whatever. It's beautiful. You know, how in the world do we make these things? That's good. But the brain also has very intense ancient circuits. The inner iguana, the inner rat, you know, the inner monkey, precious, all that. The caveman, cavewoman brain. Woo! We got to really take charge of that baby. And if we don't, it's going to take charge of us. You know, and for me, one of the key things here is this vulnerability to what I call paper tiger paranoia.
Is it true what they say that we can rewire our brain within 30 days? We can stop old habits. We can permanently release all of the previous baggage in just 30 days?
The brain actually changes within milliseconds, within fractions of a section. So literally, you know, these little neurons they talk to each other, synapses and where they connect. And neurons that are learning or changing in some way, they literally will change the sensitivity or the nature of that connection within a second or less. And then certainly within 10 minutes, you can start literally seeing electron micrographs of structural changes happening. New neurons reaching for each other, you know, or pulling back from each other. It's fairly quick. And then over days, certainly, as things consolidate, there can be, you know, structural change in the brain. And then I would say over months, research has shown that if people start doing some kind of healthy practice, like they begin some kind of mindfulness meditation, as one example, there are other examples like learning to play a musical instrument, whatever it is. You know, neurons that fire together wire together,
okay.
For better or worse, you know. And those structural changes can happen really soon. Now, the more you do, the longer you do it, the more consistent you are, you get a better change. My rule of thumb is not 30 days, actually. I think if people can do something for 3 days in a row, they're going to start creating more of a stability to it. Maybe it's not absolutely cemented, but, you know, it's like heavy clay, you know, or dry Play-Doh. They're getting, you know, some real changes are starting to occur. I think it's good to stick with it. I'm a little skeptical of these sort of numbers or rules, you know, 10,000 hours to become an expert at something, 30 days to form a habit. I think the truth for people to appreciate, which is, you know, in the book so much, Just One Thing, is to really appreciate the power of little things. Just a few things every day, a few minutes or less, a few seconds. Partly because it isn't just the benefit of what you do. It's implicitly, it's the stance in what you're doing of being on your own side, being for yourself, treating yourself like you matter, which is especially important if you've grown up to not feel so much like you matter. You know, so these, I'm a big fan of little changes. Also, you're taking action at a time when so many of us feel kind of pushed around, you know, by events and September and, you know, things that happen and, you know, and our reactions to them. It's great to feel like, at least in some ways, you're a hammer instead of a nail. You know, you're taking action. I think that's especially important for women. As a generalization, you know, you always have, I think you acknowledge that when you're talking about any group, you know, particularly groups where, you know, stereotyping and generalization has been a problem. That said, studies show generally that women often feel more at effect by pressures, expectations, demands, et cetera, and less able to just kind of swing out and be and have what's called agency, to be a cause, as it were. So as a result, women more than men are likely to have a sense of what's called learned helplessness, which is a real risk factor for depression. As well as just feeling bad in life in general. That's why I was saying that for people, certainly everybody, but women in particular, I think, it's really helpful to have this idea of practice, that I could do just a few things, and it doesn't need to be necessarily 30 days, that I can just do a few things today. Just one thing, that's my book, one thing today can actually start moving you to a better place. And I think it's important to realize that I do have the power to do that, you know. I am in some corner of my life still the boss, you know. And that's really important. So that, you know, and I'm happy about the fact that there's always something we can do, you know. including if we can't do it out there in the world, maybe we can't do it here in our body, but we can always do something inside our mind.
Yes, because our mind is the only thing that we can control, our thoughts. That is the only thing that we can control.
Yeah, or at a minimum, what we have control over is being able to observe our mind going nuts. Sometimes in the short term, you can't control your mind. It's just nuts, you know? But you can step back from the nutsiness and observe it. You can always do that.
You're listening to Law of Attraction Radio Network, enhancing the well-being of millions of listeners worldwide. LOARadionetwork.com is heard through 25 different internet radio stations, as well as iTunes Radio, Stitcher.com, and our mobile apps. The Law of Attraction Radio Network, your trusted source of daily inspiration at LOARadionetwork.com.
Okay, Rick, you said that it takes like 3 days for the new neurons in our brain to start building, which is great. But is there a limit as to when we know when we're stuck? Example, are we stuck if we notice that we're in pain and discomfort for 3 days or 3 weeks? What is the time frame to jumpstart us into changing?
That's a tough question because it depends a lot, obviously, on individual situations. And, you know, I'm not going to put it. So we're talking here about two different things. One is how soon is it time to kind of move on from an emotional reaction? And a related question, of course, is how soon is it time to, or when is it time to move on from a situation, a job, a relationship, a school you've got your kid in that's not really working out, you know, whatever, right? To do the first question, I think it depends, of course, a lot on the particular situation. You know, I had a friend die, actually, just a couple days ago. He was expected, but it happened sooner than people expected. And so it's going to take me a little while to move on from that. You know, to just say to me today, 2 days in, you know, he's really a dear guy. You know, Rick, you should not feel anything about this. I think that'd be absurd. Okay. Other times, though, you're driving in traffic, somebody's a jerk, they cut you off, and then they make a rude gesture with the middle finger of one of their hands, and all right, it's irritating, but after a few minutes of that, 20, 30 minutes later, I kind of think, you know, it might be it's time to move on. You know, so it really depends on the situation. The second thing is, the way I look at it is that there are three great phases. If you want to transform yourself or heal yourself or do spiritual practice, three great phases. The first phase is to be with what's there. Be mindful of it. Be aware of it. Feel the feelings. Experience the experience. Bear your suffering. Honor what you're feeling. You know, bow to what you're feeling. Be with it. Be mindful of it. Surround it with spacious awareness. It's always good to do that phase if you can. You know, sometimes it's too overwhelming to even be aware of it. And then, frankly, it's better to distract yourself. You know, bubble baths, comedies, sleep, you know, there's a place for that. Okay, but at a certain point, you know, it's time to move on. And sometimes things change just by being aware of them. Often, though, they keep arising. And then it's time to move to the second and third phase, where we actively, you know, second phase, release what's there, and then in the third phase, replace it with something positive. The art, of course, is to know what the Goldilocks spot is. You know, the just right spot, not too tall, short, not too hot, not too cold. When is the time to hold them? When is the time to fold them, right? And I think some people, like me, maybe because I'm a guy, what can I say? I know I'm disabled in some ways as a result. You know, I didn't like that first phase. Feel my feelings? Are you insane? You know, why would I want to feel those crummy feelings? You know, okay, I want to make them go away. But then if you try to fix them later, it doesn't have real traction. You know, it's what John Well would call the spiritual bypass. You know, you've skipped over it. You haven't really faced it or dealt with it. So on the one hand. On the other hand, I know a lot of people that get stuck in the first phase. You know, they've been told, oh, just be mindful. Mindfulness cures everything. Or they've been told, well, you should just feel it. Bear your pain, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Man, past the Goldilocks point, because neurons that fire together wire together, if you're in the pain, if you're still upset about this thing, if you're still marinating in this wound, you know, from your marriage or job or whatever, what your kids said, you know, past the point that's useful, you're doing one more lap in hell and digging a track deeper each time you go around the track because neurons that fire together wire together. And you know, then I think it's time to second and third phase. Even the Buddha, who had obviously a profound respect for mindfulness, who laid out mindfulness as he put it, the direct path to full enlightenment, and allocated one of the eight elements of the Noble Eightfold Path to right mindfulness, even such a fan as he also allocated one of the eight elements to right effort, which is about pulling weeds and planting flowers in the garden of the mind, you know. So for me, I'm a big fan of being active. I think all three phases are important, but frankly, a lot of people, you know, they don't make much effort inside their own mind, you know. They make effort out there in the world. They will be amazing for their kid, for their community, getting a stop sign down the street, you know, hiring a teacher, firing a teacher, you know, going forward in their career, learning the new version of Windows, whatever, right? They're amazing. But to make a little bit of effort inside their own mind, it's like, what? But when they do, oh my gosh, when they do just one thing inside their own mind, it creates a huge thing, you know. That's what I'd say about all that. As to when to leave situations, that's very individual, tough call. You know.
Well, I would think that the telltale sign would be if your body is saying that there's discomfort and dis-ease through the emotional thought patterns. I would have to think that that's a sign that you have to change.
A key question for me is, how can I put it, are the other people willing to repair? In other words, if on my side of the street, am I willing to be a strong partner myself? Am I willing to take responsibility for what's reasonable and what they're complaining about, even if the way they're saying it is really bugging me? All right. Am I acting with virtue? Am I having what I call unilateral virtue? Even if they're being a jerk, you know, I'm living within my code. That doesn't mean being a doormat. Also, have I been strong? Have I been firm? Have I been direct and real, et cetera, et cetera? At that point, I'm going to watch what the other person does. Are they willing to repair? Are they a reasonable partner? Will they keep their agreements? You know, do they agree to the most fundamental agreement in a relationship, that I agree to keep my agreements, right? Mm-hmm. Are they, you know, if they do it once, are they really clear they can never do it again? You know, can we repair? And if you're with someone you cannot repair with or negotiate with, I think you got to shrink the relationship.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sometimes to the point of, you know, Christmas cards and no more, you know, once a year. Right? Or, you know, and sometimes it's tough. You know, maybe it's a family member. But you do what you can to just sort of shrink or disengage. You know, maybe you arrange the seating at Thanksgiving that, you know, Uncle Bob is kind of a jerk and creepy. You know, you're at the other end of the table. Or you arrange to not spend the night and leave after dinner. Or in the job, you arrange to get a transfer to some other part of the company, or you know, spend more time in your cubicle with your, you know, iPod earbuds in, or something. You shrink the relationship if you possibly can.
Good suggestion. Let's talk about meditation. Is the meditation that you talk about in your book, it's about putting your mind on pause? Or is it about talking our way through the meditation?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I teach meditation a lot, and it's helpful, I think, to appreciate that there are many kinds of meditation. So there's not one right kind. You know, even the Buddha, who was working within a, you know, his own sort of, within his own rails, if you will, or lines. He taught many, many kinds of meditation in just that tradition, and the world has so many more traditions as well. And I would include, in the general term, meditation or contemplative practice, prayer, you know, or forms of practice that are about a relationship with something transcendental or divine or quote-unquote spiritual. Okay, so first off, many kinds. Second, in terms of mindfulness meditation, kind of broadly defined, you know, more, you know, these days a lot of people are doing that. Maybe they're using transcendental meditation, they have a mantra, maybe they're doing a more Buddhist meditation on mindfulness of breathing, maybe they're just kind of opening to divine consciousness, you know, or visualizing light, whatever it is they're doing. It's natural, in the beginning especially, for the mind to continue to be active. And the trick is not to attack the mind, because then you just stimulate the mind. The trick is to gradually allow the mind to naturally quiet while gently inclining yourself, kind of leaning toward, you know, whatever your positive action is, whether it's bringing your attention back to the breath or turning back to the mantra or turning back to the sense of connection with the divine. You know, so to me, it's a combination of gentle turning toward what's positive while disengaging from, you know, the normal activity of mind. And if you disengage, usually mind gets quieter. That's, you know, the art, there's a saying in Zen, we should be with our minds like the skillful rider of a horse, not too tight nor too loose a rein. And I think that's useful for meditating, you know, that we're gently and firmly bringing awareness back and back and back, you know, to the object of attention and helping ourselves become more and more absorbed in it. And I think that a lot of people, again, honestly, they're not making a very strong effort inside their mind, you know, and for the duration of the meditation. That's one reason why I think it's helpful to have shorter meditations, like 5, 10, 20 minutes, so you can make a stronger effort at least during that time. And sometimes help yourself. Increase the stimulation of what you're attending to, like do walking meditation, where you're kind of in a mellow way at some pace that works for you, walking back and forth and having each step maybe be a complete breath so you can keep your mind in the process. Maybe add a little saying like Thich Nhat Hanh, a great Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, peace activist, writer, has a meditation where, you know, in the in-breath, you say softly in the back of your mind, coming home, you know, and then in the exhalation, you go, I've arrived. Or you can make it simpler, like home arriving. So these are just options. But if you, for example, do something like that in rhythm with each step and each breath, that will tend to really help you stay in the meditation. After a while, science studies have shown a meditation, which has been studied a lot, which is kind of cool, that over time, you need to have less and less deliberate effort, you know, to concentrate. You're more able over time to have your mind kind of goes quiet with less effort. And, of course, some people are more natural meditators than others, you know, perfectly fine. But the net of it is I think meditation and studies are showing it has so many benefits for the mind, the heart, the body, stress chemistry, the immune system, longevity, whatever. It's to the mind what aerobic exercise is to the heart.
What about syncing both hemispheres of the brain together? Is that beneficial, especially if it's put with music? What is your opinion about that?
Yeah, it is actually. For a lot of people, you know, in medicine they call it the rule of thirds, and it's probably true in a lot of things. You know, in other words, if you're doing something, probably usually about a third of the population, a third of people get a lot out of it. About a third is kind of okay, and about a third either don't get anything out of it or, you know, it's weird, they don't like it. And I think that's true. I've heard people talk about like holosync or other binaural beats or binaural stimulation systems or other forms of feedback. I know people who love them, I've known people who are serious meditators, and they said, bam, they got inducted into states they've almost never experienced, you know, or maybe only on retreat after 7 days or something. They would get drawn in just by putting this little machine on their ears or head. I've known other people who don't like it. It feels intrusive or invasive. It kind of bugging them. My attitude generally is, you know, check it out. See if you like it.
This is really good information. And we're almost out of time. But I really want to stress to all of the listeners that I think Buddha's brain is like a first aid treatment for us to know and to take the active steps in which we can resolve the anxiety and get to that place of well-being so that we can create something much better for ourselves.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah. It's interesting. Buddha's brain has really, I think, caught attention. It's been a bestseller because I think, you know, for one, there's a lot of information about neuroscience that's great. Two, there's a greater openness to look at contemplative wisdom in all traditions in the world, not just Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, shamanic, etc., to appreciate contemplative wisdom as basically having to do with, you know, the Olympic athletes and mental training. I mean, these contemplatives have really worked our mind. And when you start to understand more what's going on in the brain, when people are in a really good place in their mind, then you can gradually reach down into your own brain with books like my own, you know, it was kind of like an operating manual for your brain and a toolbox, and then you can make changes there which will benefit your whole life, you know. And then my most recent book, Just One Thing, is even more down to earth. It's less technical. It's really for everybody. You know, if you've got a, you know, an open-minded friend and somewhere who's just not that into all this brain stuff and Buddhism, but is open-minded, Just One Thing has all these little practices people can do that will really make a change for them.
And it will de-stress you. Very important.
Yeah. Actually, I think that's really true. People describe, bam, you know, within a minute. I mean, I'm an experienced therapist, and also I've been, you know, practicing, working on myself for about 35 years because I was so miserable when I was a kid. But anyway, great background for a future therapist, pretty common one. But my point is that, you know, what's really striking is the fact that little things can make a big difference. You know, you just see that again and again and again. And, you know, I'm very happy about that.
That's great.
There's stuff you can do.
Tell people how they can get your books.
Oh, you're kind. Well, they're available anywhere, really. Buddhist Brain is the first one, and then Just One Thing has come out now, 2 years later. You know, any online seller, a local bookstore. I'm a fan of local bookstores. They can also go to my website, which is full of free resources. It's just chock full. Slide sets, images, videos from presentations I've given in workshops or freely offered, the audio of talks I've given, as well as other resources like really neat websites about the brain and that are practical and down to earth. And some of them are for kids. They're pretty neat. I like the ones for kids. They're often the clearest, you know, and the most immediately useful. They cut right to the chase, which I like.
Absolutely.
So my websites, they can reach it through BuddhistBrain.com, BuddhistBrain.com.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate all this information. And I want to have you back on so that we could perhaps do a meditation.
Well, I'll leave people with one little practical thing they can do right now. Take me less than a minute. Basically, it's the idea of taking in the good. This is one of the practices in the book, Just One Thing, taking in the good. It's so important because the brain's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones, because that was a great way to keep our ancestors alive in the wild, but it's lousy today, you know, for quality of life, et cetera, et cetera. So, three steps to taking in the good. One, let good facts become good experiences. You know, first of all, notice good facts. A lot of people don't. And then second, let them move your needle. You know, the flowers are blooming, kids are laughing, ain't dead yet, you know, the air is reasonably good, coffee smells good, chocolate tastes great, whatever. Your partner's nice to you. You get a little laundry done. There's been a good fact. Let it move your needle. Second, savor it. Get those neurons to fire together so they wire together. Trick your brain. Stay with it 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row. What a sweet practice. Feel good for half a minute. That's what Doc Rick says. Wow, that's tough medicine. I got to feel good for half a minute a few times a day. Oh, man. Well, that's how you change your brain. You know, stay with it, okay? And then, meanwhile, third step, sense and intend that it's going into you, all right? You're priming memory systems. You're helping them register this experience in emotional memory. It's not about remembering the event, you know? It's not about recollecting an episode. It's about taking the experience, the positive experience you've earned, you've had or stumbled upon in your life either way, and then really helping it go in. So if people do this right now, maybe with something they're grateful for, I'm grateful to you. Very nice show. You have a really great face.
Thank you.
I'm grateful for having a life at a time when things like Skype can occur, you know, and internet. And there's so much access to information these days, or whatever it is. And then let yourself feel good, and then that good feeling sinks in. Hey, half a dozen times a day, 15, 30 seconds at a time. Maybe for a minute just before sleep when your mind is really receptive, or helping kids do it just before sleep, you know, taking in the good experience for kids, like putting a jewel in the treasure chest of their heart. This is a good practice.
So,
leave you with this one.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Thank you so much. And that really gets us thinking for the entire next week, right up until our next show. So, thanks again, Rick. It was such a treat. Please come back. And to all my wonderful, fantastic, glorious, magnificent Listeners, thank you. And I look forward to talking with you again next week. Have a great one. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another great show from Law of Attraction Talk Radio. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send an email to Jules@LOARadionetwork.com and have a great week.